step right up. The show's about to begin. Forget your troubles and raise your cups. Here's to this moment, it will never happen again. This is Offstage and On the Air, performance number 676. I'm Lisa Sheps, and I'm joined once again by guest co-host Matrix Kilgore.
Hello, my friends. So good to be here.
You're listening to us on KOOP HD1 HD3 Hornsby, streaming live as we do every July at koop.org. Remember, if it's theater, it's on Offstage and On the Air. Don't go away.
Hurry, hurry, step right up. The show's about to begin. Forget your troubles and raise your cup. Step right up. Feast your eyes on the wonders of this world. Oh, yeah.
Come and get it. Come and get it. Come and get it.
Says he. It says a mighty morning is nigh, universal 4th of July.
It is Wednesday, July 6th, 2022. It's hot here in Austin, Texas. Therefore, we are going to talk to the folks over at Summerstock Austin, done by Impact Arts. And of course, we're going to have lively discussions of the world of theater in Austin, Chicago, New York, Detroit, and Yazoo City, Michigan. Stick with us. Gonna get your test on a movie screen. Okay, Matrix, you're just staring at me like you don't know what I'm talking about because you couldn't hear that on your headphones because you're not wearing any.
Not at all. But it was good.
It was good. That great Come and Get It Day from Finian's Rainbow. Ooh. A show that it dawns on me that I know very little about. You know, before we start talking, I'm going to introduce the people here with us so that they can continue in this conversation.
Oh, yeah, good call.
We have Ginger Morris. Welcome back, Ginger.
Hello. Thanks for having me. I'm so excited to be here today.
We're excited to have you here. And Michael Avila, how are you?
Avila, yes.
Yeah, I did. I know that too.
Thank you so much for having me.
No, you're welcome. So the reason why I needed to make sure, normally we don't introduce our guests right then because we do a little shot, but have you done Finian's Rainbow and Summerstock Austin and anything like that?
No, and actually just now when you were saying it's a show you don't know much about, I don't either.
It just dawned on me, I don't think I've ever seen it. I get it mixed up with the other one. What's the Brigadoon?
Brigadoon. So do I.
I've done Brigadoon.
Well, who hasn't?
Yeah.
And you know what? Not apropos of nothing. I don't know if the others of you are a big fan of Schmigadoon, but season 2 is going to be coming out featuring the musicals of the 60s and 70s.
Aren't they changing the name to like Schmicago or something?
I don't think they're changing the name, but maybe Schmicago. It wouldn't be Schmicago, it would be Schmare.
Okay.
Or Schmises Schmei Schmooper Schmar. anyway, so and I pulled that out because there was, and now I can't find it. I was going to bring it up on the computer, but Playbill did a. They have these quizzes where you go through and can you guess these shows from their 4th of July lyrics? And I always go, I'm going to ace this thing. I knew nothing. I knew very little. And as a matter of fact, I made a really stupid mistake confidently, and I wish I could bring it up here, thinking I said, that's Oklahoma. But no, it was Carousel. Anyway, I want to take this time to thank Kim Simpson again for another wonderful International Folk Bazaar. You know, as I listen to him and talk about that show, and he does such great pronunciations of all the words and all these in his... His show comprises of all these different countries and all these different languages. I think that English is one of the few languages that doesn't trill their R's. And I think we should add a trill to our language.
Just add it.
Yeah.
I mean,
well, we did have
shifts.
Ruffles have ridges.
Yes.
We did have that once upon a time. I don't know. Just a suggestion. Merriam-Webster listened to the show, so.
It's a difficult skill to master, definitely.
Well, some people can't do it.
Right. Yeah. Right.
As a matter of fact, we have an intern working with us at the theater, and her name is Andrea. And I asked her how she wants, you know, how would you like us to pronounce your name? Because I, especially folks without, like, I'm doing air quotes, American names. Do we pronounce it the way they are pronounced in that language? But it's up to the person. So she said, well, if people can trill their R's, I want them to call me Andrea. And I went, beautiful. I love that.
Yeah.
That's it. So Andrea it is. Andrea. You've just learned that I can trill my R's.
Skills.
Yes. I can also, because I'm Jewish, do this. Because Hebrew has those wonderful sounds.
I don't know where to go with that one.
We just had the 4th of July holiday. Anybody do anything fun?
Yeah, my family has like a family retreat every 4th. It was great.
Invited. Yeah.
Yeah, well, next time.
That's good. Anybody else? Y'all were working.
We were. Yeah. We had the day off, technically, so. Mm-hmm.
All right,
don't
that's
worry.
Good.
Yeah. So everybody got to have their, you know, day off this week, but I was working.
Well, and of course, the 4th of July is kind of a problematic holiday these days, not only for just its origin, and I should say that the opinions expressed here on offstage and on the air are not necessarily those of the staff and board of co-op, merely my own opinion. But I mean, it's, you know, we're celebrating imperialism. We're celebrating taking lands away from other people anyway. But now, currently, here in Austin, Texas, we're also burning our city up with fireworks.
Oh.
And I'm really happy. Normally, I don't know why I'm talking about this on this show, but in my neighborhood, there's a family that always blows off lots of fireworks. They have kids, and they do. And a note went out on our neighborhood thing saying, please don't do fireworks this year. The ground is so blah, 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 blah. And they didn't. So happy and proud.
Oh, look at that.
That is impressive.
Community.
Mm-hmm.
One good thing about July 4th is that was like, I read, one of the few days for slaves that got free. So a lot of black families have these family reunions on July 4th because that was one of the times historically where they could leave the plantations and meet up with family.
That's bittersweet.
It is. But it's a tradition that still holds to these days.
Good for you.
Never heard that.
Yeah. I haven't either. So we like to teach things here on Offstage and on the Air. It's hard-hitting journalism. I saw, and I just blasted past this thing. There was, over the 4th of July weekend, they had a free streaming of Donny Osmond's Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. Now, I am a big fan of Joseph. I'm seeing The Matrix.
I love it.
You love it. What about y'all? Because it's usually one or the other. People love it or they don't.
I have mixed emotions about it. I see its appeal. I see its appeal, especially when working with young people. Is it artistically the best creation? I'm not so sure.
I don't think that was the purpose of it.
It's fun. Mm-hmm. And I feel like if I'm in the mood for fun, it's fun. But it's certainly not in, you know, my top 10.
Definitely not top 10.
I agree with that. Well, so back in the 80s, there were two tours that were going out at the same time. One was helmed by Donny Osmond. The other was, he was a soap opera star, Michael something. Anyway, they were going out at the same time. I saw the Michael something one several times because a very dear friend of mine was in it. Never saw the Donny Osmond, but I heard wonderful things about it. And so I was very disappointed when I missed the stream, the free stream that was on. But then I started to think about it. There was that god-awful movie that they made of Joseph with Donny Osmond, and it was terrible.
That's what I thought you were talking about at first, and I was like, ooh.
Oh, that was, this is, I don't like that.
Yeah. I didn't know there was a different one.
Well, I don't know that they filmed his performance. So that was a filmed piece.
Correct.
Not a filming of the show, which is what I thought, but I think it was probably that piece, which I don't recommend anybody to waste an hour and a half.
My only critique is his Close Every Door was a little pushed, a little rushed.
Yeah.
But, you know.
Yeah, that's how he was directed, I think.
Yeah.
Donnie. So right before I came here, as a matter of fact, before, you know, after I had done my script and stuff, the New York Times came out with an article written by Jesse Green that says, when paying dues doesn't pay the rent, how does theater survive? And I just wanted to talk about it a little bit here. The premise of the story is, you know, we in the arts community think it's okay, and in many cases it's it is looked upon with as a badge of valor to pay your dues, that working for free or even paying to work or working for reduced salary in the arts is considered to this day okay by us and by the world at large. And I just sort of want to have a little discussion about that. Does that bring up any feelings for anybody?
Yeah, I mean, I think it. Okay, we were talking about this before, and I feel like we used all our good material.
We did. We said some really good stuff.
But I feel like the idea of the starving artist is in some masochistic way, like, appealing. If it's hard, I have to suffer for my art to get it. But then you look back and you're like, golly, I really was giving away a lot.
Well, and back in the day, summer stock specifically, you would have these interns, 40, 50 interns that would not only not get paid, but they usually paid to be part of it. And to work with these big stars, they would be paying like $4,000 or $5,000 for the summer to clean toilets.
And then not get treated well.
And not get treated well. I don't know. It frustrates me as a theater maker here in Austin. We've often talked about how most people cannot make a living in this industry here in town. And it's a snowball effect. And I don't know where it's a chicken and egg thing as well, because I run a theater. I pay people. I do not pay them a living wage. I do not get paid a living wage. But I don't have the budgets in order to do that. So how do we train our donors and our sponsors and the philanthropists out there that arts workers deserve what plumbers get?
I do think that's really interesting about the development and the fund development part of it. I think Austin has an interesting culture of philanthropy. And the organizations also have the trickle down of that. It's an interesting history. But, you know, we talk about the musicians. If you don't pay a living wage, they're not playing any music.
This is just speculation. I don't know. But I do feel like there's something in, like, it feels like for a mechanic, for instance, there's skills that you have to have that are very clear measures and markers of, like, oh, you have all the things you need to learn to fix a car. Or other things have like a very clear, you know, you go through this process and this degree, and once you have it, you're considered skilled enough to have this job. And I think there's like a misnomer of what a skilled artist is. So no one knows how to assess or how to say this person's work is worthy of this amount of money. We just don't have culturally a system that supports that mentality. And so I just think, I don't have any answer, but I do think that that is.
I think it's also important to mention that this shines a light on accessibility and, you know, entering the industry, especially for artists of color or people who are not born into the profession and have those automatic connections. But, for instance, charging somebody to participate in summer stock automatically excludes a large portion of
And that
of
was brought
artists.
Up here. It's like right. Typically those interns were white and resourced.
Sure, sure.
Yeah, so huge accessibility issue. I want to just read a little piece from here. There is a consultant named Elsa Hiltner. I don't know anything else about her other than that, but she works with theater. And talking about pay equity, Soho Rep, by the way, recently introduced a living wage job creation program, and it's starting planning. Ground Floor Theater here has talked about a similar kind of program that we're talking about, not necessarily maybe a living wage program, but more equitable, transparent way of paying people across the board. But she says, quote, there's not enough Well, let me back up. If theater, as Hiltner puts it, operates under the scarcity model, there's not enough and there never will be more. Perhaps it's because we undervalue ourselves. Noxious stories about the value of suffering and a lifetime of scrounging exist to convince ourselves of the false idea that a passion cannot be a profession. If the arts industry starts valuing the art, Hiltner says, that will ripple out and impact the way people donate and the way corporations and foundations give support. If we stop thinking of resources as scarce, she adds, maybe they finally won't be.
And I think that starts really early, right? I remember in high school, I would have to sign this contract that would say everything that I was doing for the school. But the school never told me anything that they were going to do for me. I was trained that I am to give of myself of everything and not expect much in return.
Right. And I think that that kind of trickles down to the... I think that's the kind of thing that the arts organizations do mm-hmm. to this day.
Yeah.
Agreed.
And it's interesting that the hierarchy, and it's funny that in smaller theater and community theater, maybe not on Broadway, but yeah, I would even say to an extent to commercial theater, but the people that are valued the least are the performers, specifically the actors, because as Matrix says, musicians, they say no. but they're valued the least. But if you look in one of the models that I'm looking at is like figuring out how many hours each person works and then pay everybody the same hourly rate. Actors work probably more hours than many other people in the creation of a theater piece.
And I would argue that a lot of the audience comes for those actors.
Sure.
Like they are in the theater because they want to see the actors.
True. And in our market in theater, it's like you want a big cast show because that gives you a larger audience. Yeah. Yeah. Like when you do a two-hander, you go, okay, well, those people are going to invite the five people they know. That's 10 that are coming.
Just saying, my two-hander at Ground Floor was wonderful.
It
and
was
sold out.
People still talk about it, and he's talking about single black female. I'm assuming that's what
you're
talking
about.
Yeah, that's it. It was a two-hander. As a matter of I'll tell you later.
Okay.
I have just a really great story about single black female, and I should say single black female has done it. Was the last thing that Ground Floor Theater did before the pandemic, written by Lisa B. Thompson, the incomparable. Just a couple of things that I found interesting that are going on. Did you see this production of Othello that they're doing in the West End with a black director?
Oh, I was going to say,
that's like
Othello
the
in the
first
West End.
Time
nervous.
In a major theater in England that a black director is directing Othello, which seems crazy to me. And I want to bring this up because I've got to find my article. So for no other reason to give the name of this director that I can't remember. Actually, it's not the director. It's an actor. It is being directed by a black man. But this article talks about Hamilton star Giles Terrera. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly. I believe he won an Olivier for the Hamilton in England. But it is directed by Clint Dyer. It's making the first time the play has been directed by a black man at a major British venue, which I think is very interesting. But what they talked about in this article a lot was just the way we've traditionally looked at Othello, and it tends to be from the angle of Iago, and not really focusing on Othello, who is a black man that made his way up through the ranks in a European country. And so this production is going to be taking a much more equitable view of the piece, which I thought was interesting. And as I look at it, I go, duh, they're also giving more agency to Desdemona mm-hmm. and talking more about the relationship as a relationship like that would have been in real life.
I mean, even the photos that they're using to talk about it, it seems more grounded and like not this toxic masculinity image of Othello like being this conqueror.
Right, this conqueror and a dupe of Iago.
Yeah, well. Well, there's something there why we've been looking at it through the eyes of Iago, just saying.
That's true. So this is a National Theater. It's going to come to cinemas worldwide in 2023 through NT Live. And you can go to offstageonair.com, look at the article, and you can get a link to get more information about that. But they were talking, they talked a lot about Trevor Nunn's production of and how problematic that was and how it was done through a totally white lens. And it's interesting. A lot of us never really thought of that before. But back in the day, you know, we used to talk about, if you read Olivier's biography, Gielgud and Olivier would switch off doing Othello and Iago. And obviously, they're both white guys. So at least 50% of those were done in blackface. And that was perfectly okay back in the day.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Sort of why Othello has a kind of a bad taste in my mouth.
Well, and it should. And I mean, it should have a bad taste in all of our mouths.
Yeah.
Well, and for me, it brings up questions of what are we teaching? In a lot of secondary school curriculums, Shakespeare is still the go-to, but we don't introduce our young artists that that Shakespeare is for all, or we don't incorporate other playwrights of color or actors of color. And so even our young artists are exposed, even in high school, middle school programs, to Shakespeare as the be-all, end-all of theater, the pinnacle of theater.
Which I've never understood.
Right.
And ever. The only taste of heightened language.
Yes. Which then leads these young artists to not see themselves in the theater and becomes very exclusionary.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's true. Well, also, tangentially, Bank of America and Activate Award, granting awards came up. Sorry, I got it. It's Theater Forward. It's a group called Theater Forward, along with Bank of America, did their Activate Awards. And it's some grants of $50,000 each, but and it's about equity. They are... this program accelerates regional theaters' efforts to create a more equitable and inclusive environment. And here locally, or sort of locally, the Alley Theater was a recipient of those grants. Mm. That's good for them. Also along with them, the other five are the Actors Theater of Louisville, Alliance Theater, Center Theater Group, the Long Wharf, and, turn the page, the Old Globe in San Diego. Hmm. I, of course, just ran to the website to see how I could get that, and you can't.
You got to be invited.
I believe you have to be a Lord Theater. So, you know, therein lies the. I didn't read the fine print on that one. I really wanted to get that.
And the Actors Theater of Louisville has consistently been doing some really great work in equity for a while now. So I'm glad that they're getting their shine.
Yeah, and it's important that people are out there doing work and trying to do things equitably, that they get recognized for it and supported financially. Okay, I'm going to say that for the last... where was the thing that I wanted to talk... Oh, the Mariupol Theater Company. Did you read this article?
Yes.
So this is a theater company in Mariupol, Ukraine. We heard in the news, 2 months ago about this theater that was bombed. They had written children on the top, and it got bombed anyway, and people were set inside of it for a long time. So this is a story about this troupe of actors and theater makers that were trapped in there, and then they are back, and they are going to be doing they're in rehearsals for a show right now. And this is in the New York Times. I'm now, of course, searching for the article. There it is.
Just amazed me, the resiliency of theater and the power to bring people together to speak of an experience and process in a way.
Yeah. So this is an article in New York Times written by Megan Especia. I'm sure I'm mispronouncing that. And it just talks about this theater company and not only what they're doing, and they're actually in rehearsal for a show about a Russian... it's something that took place prior to all this, but still, I think it took place in the 80s, maybe in Soviet-era Russia. It's based on the life and works of Vasil Stus, sure I'm mispronouncing that, a Ukrainian poet, human rights activist, dissident, and nationalist hero. So he was put on trial twice in the Soviet Union for some of the stuff he did, and he died on a hunger strike. But one of the things they said in this article, or these theater makers said, they talk about the saying, "The king is dead. Long live the king." They turned that around and said, "So the theater died. Long live the theater."
Yeah.
And I remember hearing about how they bombed that theater, and it just broke my heart. One of the things that this theater company is doing, so most of these people were in the region of Ukraine that's now just being taken over completely by Russia. But they, back then, they produced mostly in Russian. So it's very interesting that you have so close together. It always amazes me that a line in the ground, the language changes. Mm. I remember when I went from the Czech Republic and I stepped into Poland, the language just went from Czech to Polish, like in a heartbeat. How do they do that? Anyway, it's like magic. It's like a thermos.
I don't know what that means, but okay.
Well, it keeps things hot and it keeps things cold. How does it know?
Oh, okay. I got you. I follow. I track now. I track.
But they, 2 years ago, they decided to switch to performing in all Ukrainian. And so they have actors that only speak Russian and they have to learn how to speak Ukrainian. And I find that interesting. Anyway, this show that they're doing, which is going to be done in the Uzerhurad Theater, opens in mid-July. And you can see that article at offstageonair.com.
Wow.
And I'm just blown by the time. So I want to talk about two things, and one specifically because y'all are here. There's an article, again, I believe in the New York Times. Nope. Stand by. Anyway, it's the it's about a little group called the Jimmy Awards, and this is on BroadwayNews.com. And just talking about, I want to spend a moment talking about arts education. We talk about this a lot. So the Jimmy Awards, as we know, is an analog. They came up with this because of our Heya Awards. That was a joke. It went the other way around.
It did definitely go the other way around.
But they talked about the coaches and judges that got together afterwards and just talked about how important arts education, specifically theater education, is to people. And one of the judges, and did a lot of talking here, was Montego Glover. And she said, I'll just give this quote and then open it up to anybody else who wants to say anything. She said, quote, "There will never not be young men and women who want to express a way that is artistic or that is elevated from what we see in everyday world. And making space for that, encouraging it, cultivating it, and training it so that they can really be the best humans they want to be and therefore contribute to our communities and their own families and lives, it's all cyclical and it works." So, did you tell us why arts education is so important?
It's a big, broad question, right. Lisa. Thank you. Well, I mean, I have a lot of personal, obviously, I care deeply about arts education. It has pretty much been part of what I do since since I was little and took part in it and then continued to grow there. But I personally credit my growing up in the theater with my ability to be who I am and do what I do. Because arts education became so much part of what I wanted to give back, is about that, right? Like, you go, well, how do I help the next generation to have access to developing the skills of being a human? And how do we help young people to be comfortable with who they are, to be comfortable and understanding of all of the people around them and the world around them, and how theater is that thing that does that. It builds community. It brings people together that wouldn't necessarily be together and says, let's share stories. Let's share time together. Let's talk about other people and understand other people, other cultures. I think there's just so much about people getting together and doing theater that other things don't they don't do the way theater does it. And it's not just about, you know, the making of the theater, but it's what are you learning about yourself in that time? And so many people who do theater as young people don't continue in theater, right? It's really, how are we helping young people to have confidence in themselves? How are we helping them to be able to communicate feelings and thoughts with other people? And so if they end up, you know, running a business or, you know, whatever they end up doing, it's how, and storytelling. I think everyone I talk to that doesn't work in the theater anymore but once did theater, one of the biggest things that they talk about is anything you do in the world, like, you have to be able to tell a story. That's how humans have always functioned. That's
from
how we are always going to function. And so, and you can't do math and learn to tell a story. You can't. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with learning to do math, but that's not storytelling. And theater is the one thing that says, how do we tell stories? How do we actually communicate with each other in that fashion? And I just, obviously, I have a lot of passion about it, but I but I just don't see that anywhere else.
That is a great point. And I look at growing up and as a young person working in theater, and just the steps you take as a performer and as a theater maker to get from, you know, reading the script all the way to performing, the amount of research, the amount of discussion, the amount of rehearsal, team building, all those things add up to that show. And you do that over and over again. It teaches you all those skills.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Michael.
Yeah. I mean, full transparency, I was a high school theater teacher for 10 years, but as a young person, I was also a band kid throughout my secondary years, middle school and high school, and I credit that participation in the arts and music specifically for teaching collaboration, mm-hmm. and discipline and time management, and as Ginger mentioned, so many of those students who don't go into theater, so many of the skills that we teach and learn in theater programs, in music programs, in visual arts programs are transferable into the workforce, into, you know, college and career readiness. So even though we might not be producing professional actors and designers and directors, we are producing better humans with empathy and you know, and future theater patrons or patrons of the arts in
Absolutely.
General who can appreciate it and discuss it and just, you know, appreciate it for what it is.
And better communicators. I have a friend that works at Virginia Tech working with scientists, getting them out of the lab and telling their story of the discoveries and the work that they're doing in a lab. We create community and we create storytellers, and there will always be a need for that.
In every way of life. Well, that's great. I could talk about this forever. I want to just mention one other thing. People have been talking, and I've got several friends that have been going to and are going to or currently in London right now, and what should they see? And I keep going to the show And Juliet, which we talked about here on the program, which is coming to Broadway. It's currently on the West End. And Juliet posits... Well, let me just play this little bit from the trailer. Maybe people can understand what I'm about to say.
Juliet plunges Romeo's dagger into her heart.
What if Juliet didn't kill herself? I mean, really, that should almost be the start of the play.
Hit me, baby, one more time.
So it makes the story about Juliet, and it basically starts after Romeo is dead. It just looks amazing. That piece that I played there from that is from the trailer. There's a link to it at offstageonair.com, and you can see it. It just looks like so much fun. Has anybody heard anything about it?
Mainly what you just said. I know it takes a lot of, you know, pop songs
it's
and
all
contemporary
pop songs,
music.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Yeah, looks like a lot of fun. Can't wait to see it. It's kind of six-ish in a weird way, but there's a narrative in this one. Six doesn't have a narrative.
Six is a rock concert, a lovely rock concert.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's another example of how to connect older classical canon with young people.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It's a great vehicle
and shifting power dynamics, which is important. So let's take a little break. We'll listen to a little bit more of And Juliet, and we'll come back and we'll talk to Ginger and Michael about all the great stuff that they're doing for the next half hour. Well, You're going to be doing it for more than a half an hour, but we're going to talk to you for a half an hour. Here, we'll be right back.
It's my life.
We should rewrite all your plays.
We are back. You're listening to Offstage and On the Air with Lisa and...
Matrix.
Matrix.
Hello.
And we just had a lovely conversation, which included the two of us and Ginger Morris and Michael Avila. And now we're going to switch and talk to Michael and Ginger specifically about why they are here. And that is Summer Stock Austin, which is always an amazing trio of great musical performances done by youngsters. And you know, I'm going to stop talking and let you describe what it is, Ginger. What is it and what are you doing this year?
All right. Thank you so much. We're excited to talk about what we're doing this year. We are doing two live productions. They will run in rep. We're partnering with Texas Performing Arts, so we'll be at the McCullough Theater.
That's exciting. That is a change.
Yes. We just moved there last year with our production of Bring It On.
Right.
And so we're partnering again this year and doing two live shows. And so Michael and I are co-directing In the Heights.
Of my absolute faves.
So excited.
Yeah, I have to say that that's the one show I went to see on Broadway and bought a ticket to see it again the next night.
Oh,
like
wow.
That,
oh, wow.
I was just like in it to win it when I went to see that show. And I've never gotten to work on it, so it's very exciting. And then we are doing a new musical. It is an original musical for all ages. It's called Alice's Wonderland. It is co-written by J. Quentin Johnson. And he's actually music directing both of our live shows. And he's directing the piece that he co-wrote. And he wrote all the music for Alice's Wonderland as well. He is a tour de force like none other.
A busy guy.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. And I would encourage people, and maybe I'll put it in our notes, our friend Adam Roberts on his podcast Colo Voce did a wonderful interview with Quentin, and you go, oh my god, this guy's like this little savant. He's amazingly
he's
smart.
He's incredible.
In college he would like sit with this keyboard in the atrium at UT just playing music, and I was like, well, he's busy.
He's always busy. Mm-hmm. He likes to stay busy, and that has made him very, very very successful at many things. So yeah, we're super, and also it's just very exciting to have him in the room with young people. He has a spirit and a heart and a love and a passion for the kind of work that we are doing that honestly just, I don't know how to say it, but you get in a room with a bunch of young people who are excited and you put him in that room with them, and their level of enthusiasm just, I don't know, it's palpable. It's
and
awesome.
Just to give folks, if they don't know Quentin, just the caliber of this man, he is a longtime alum of Hamilton,
yes,
which he won pre-COVID, his very first audition.
Yeah.
He got a leading role in Hamilton. He played Thomas Jefferson and Hurricane Mulligan.
Mulligan, yeah. He's a cover for several of the leads on Broadway right now.
Sure.
So literally the morning he flew in to work with us, the night before he played Hamilton on Broadway and then caught a flight at 5 a.m. to come work with us for our first day together.
That happens to me all the time.
All the time. All the time. So his show, and I have to tell you, when we started planning the season, I was like, we should just do two big shows everyone knows. Like, we shouldn't be working that hard to force people to the theater. We need to like just open our arms and get people back in. So I was like, Hello Dolly and In the Heights, we'll get everyone. Quentin sent me this, you know, musical. He sent me the tracks and the script, and he's like, you should, you know, just check it out. And literally, I read the script, I listened to the music, and I fully changed my mind in 2 seconds. I was like, we're doing this show. It's super well written. It's very clever. It the music is very contemporary and cool, lots of different styles. And I don't, the whole story, I think everybody should see. The story right, is really... Yeah, I mean, it's very much about believing in yourself and you know, when just because other people may not believe in your art and your creativity doesn't change that you're of value and that what you do is of value. It's beautiful and is hilarious and very dynamic. It's actually about a young female coder, and she...
Game developer.
And she is developing this game called, Wonderland, where it's based on Alice in Wonderland, but it's like this sort of utopian view of Wonderland. And then she ends up in her own game, and everything is falling apart. It's dystopian, and she basically has to level up to confront the Queen of Hearts, who is like a pop star idol who's taken over, and she has to confront her to like get her world that she created back. And it's dynamic, it's cool. Quentin wrote it and is getting to direct it, which is really exciting. So that piece, I think, is really cool and not something, you know, that is... typically done. No. Or, you know, so we're very excited about doing that. And I think that and In the Heights has offered us an opportunity, I think, to expand both the students in our program as well as our creative team in ways that we have not had that, or I should say we've not taken that opportunity.
And the final piece is this, is a filmed piece.
Yes. So we just started last year. Prior to COVID, we used to do 3 shows that ran in rep, and one was an original musical for family audiences, and Alan Robertson and Damon Brown would co-write this new musical. And for years, so they both were part of the Biscuit Brothers and did TV for, you know, years, and they kept saying, we should do an original movie musical as part of Summer Stock. And I literally for 3 years said, how would we fit that in? I can't even see that, you know? And so I'm super grateful that that during the pandemic, we were like, oh, well, making a movie would be a little bit more feasible in this time. So I said, maybe this is a good time to try it. And so we made Scout last year, which was our first one, and we sent it to film festivals, and it did really well. So we were like, whoa, maybe we should do this again. So when I talked to Damon and Alan, and Scout was very much about like accepting change and understanding that the, you know, things out of your control change. And it's from the perspective of a 13-year-old girl. And it was very, you know, I think it was the right time for that story in our lives. This show this year, we were talking about what we wanted to do. And we were like, we should do something that's fun, you know, that just gives us a lot of joy and that we can giggle and have some sentimental, you know, moments. But it's called How to Musical Theater. And it's actually so sweet. It is about a sort of, you know, I'll say 14-year-old, 15-year-old guy. And he's kind of struggling to figure out how he fits in, what his purpose is, yada, yada. And he gets dropped in a park in a musical theater number. So we partnered with Peace Park.
As things happen.
As they do, of course. And we shot it at Peace Park, and we're actually
doing great locations there.
Oh my God, so yeah. Pretty. And so we'll be doing the movie premiere and showing it actually at Peace Park in August. And
so is it already in the can? Is it done?
We finished shooting, so it is now in post-production. It's editing. But it's super fun because ultimately it goes through a series of, you know, why is acting in musical theater important? Why is singing important? Why is dancing important? And at the end, it's really about, you know, it's about finding a community and finding a place and being comfortable with who you are. And the last number is called A Life Worth Singing For.
Wow.
So where he goes back into the pie, shouldn't give this away. Should let everyone
see spoiler.
It. Folks should just probably watch
probably
it.
Should come see it.
Mm-hmm. All sounds amazing. Let's talk about In the Heights. The two of you are co-directing. In the Heights is one of my favorites. And I also love it because that's where I lived in New York for most of my time in New York. I had an apartment on 162nd and Riverside for 11 years.
We should ask Lisa some questions.
Yes. Oh, I know. Everything there is to know about the Washington Heights in the 70s and 80s. So I could tell you how to sell drugs.
Yeah, share that with the students.
Yeah, exactly. But what a fun thing. How are you guys approaching it? And are you easily and succinctly able to describe how you co-directed, how you're meshing your two talents?
Yes, and Ginger and I have a little bit of a history together. As I mentioned, I was a high school theater director for many years in San Antonio, and Ginger would drive down and choreograph my shows that I was directing. And about 5 years ago, I made the jump up to UT, and we're like, hey, we're both in town, let's work together. So got involved with the Heller Awards for Young Artists as a judge, and we knew we wanted to do something for Summer Stock. It took us about 3 years to finally figure it out. But finally, last year, I came on with Bring It On. And I think what's important to both
Which
of
I have,
us...
I have to say, I did not get to see last year, and I'm kicking myself in the hiney the whole time.
You should, because I did, and I was like, all right, okay, it's cheerleading. But then I saw it, and I was on the edge of my seat the entire time.
Never heard a negative word about it.
So I think that was a great step coming back from COVID, but also kind of exploring how Summer Stock could provide more opportunities for young artists, and specifically for young artists of color who don't necessarily have opportunities or as many opportunities, not only to participate in programs like this, but also to play characters that they can connect with that are of their own lived experience. And so choosing a show like In the Heights that centers stories of people and communities of color definitely, I think, in my opinion, we definitely leveled up for Summer Stock. And as far as how, I mean, we bounce ideas off each other, where Ginger might focus on choreography and staging, I'm worried about character and story and continuity. And, you know, so I think that's a good way to describe that relationship.
Well, it's an amazing piece, and it moves fast, and it has great stories of the Dominican life that folks had. That is a Dominican area. Most of the people were from the Dominican Republic that lived there, and it's the music is great. And of course, we all know Lin-Manuel Miranda nowadays is doing it. How big is the cast for this? And in general, also with Summer Stock Austin, how big is what's the group makeup this year?
In the Heights. A little over 30 for In the Heights, 24, something like that for Alice, and about 24 for the movie musical. And lots of the students overlap, obviously. But between performers, technicians, interns, all of the high school, college students, and we have some middle schoolers who are involved this year too, I think about 100 total who are participating.
That's awesome. That's great.
Did you have anything?
Yeah, I also want to talk about like them playing in rep. Opportunity most people don't get to do until they are well into their careers in some ways.
Well, and even much, it's not done so much anymore. So you don't even, a lot of people never get the opportunity to do that.
I have never done a show in rep.
It's funny, Vincent Hooper did Summer Stock for several years, and he is the one person we always say is the one person we had play roles in three different shows when we were doing three shows in rep, and we were like, we will never do it again. We really appreciate you doing that because he has a lot of stamina, but that was a lot to ask of any one human, because we used to do like three show days, so he would have to do like three roles in a day.
That's a lot.
But he does say that when he went, he also was in a production of Hamilton in several productions of Hamilton, actually.
He was on the road for a long time as well.
And he was like, I really credit that summer of playing three roles and having that stamina to do that to help me to do what I'm doing. He was swinging, so it was really helpful for him to swing after having that experience.
Sure.
one of the things that is specific to what we do is that students are in one or two shows and then typically have a crew position. And when Michael McKelvey and I started SummerStock in 2005, SummerStock Austin, there were several things that we wanted to make sure were part of the experience. And he and I had both worked for theater companies that had educational programs, but the educational program was not the main thrust of the company. It was sort of the part of the company that was supposed to help the company to survive so they could make the shows that the professionals or the adults were in. And both of us were like, what can we do where the young people are the number one value of the experience? So that was part of it. And then we also saw a lot of programs, and I'm not disparaging any program for doing this, but pay-to-play programs are very popular. They always have been. So if you're in high school and you're, you know, whatever, you're a young talent, you want to be in some shows, you pay and you are in a show. And so that was one of the things we definitely wanted to remove Yep. from the experience. And then we also wanted students to get a better understanding of everything that's involved in creating art. And I think for me personally, I grew up performing and I had no idea what anything cost. I had no idea that there were people that were doing all kind, you know, I knew that like there was a box office, but I didn't really know what they were doing. And, you know, I knew that there is so many things
so
that
important.
You just don't realize are happening. So that's a huge part of what we do. And we had our company meetings last week and we went through a lot of like, why are we learning all of these things? And so they do fundraising and marketing and they crew a show, they work house for the shows, all of it for the value, hopefully that they are more appreciative of all of the work that goes on around them, but also because those are career possibilities. Also, most of the people that I know that are working professionally in arts admin started out as, you know, performers. And so but maybe didn't know that was even an avenue to go in. And you go like, oh, marketing is also storytelling. Interesting. Yeah. Maybe that's something that I excel at that I could, you know, would want to be doing with my career. So I think it's those were some of the tenets that started the
and
program.
I applaud you for that. I mean, that I was fortunate enough in my very early theater life to have a director that insisted that we all know how everything works. And that saved my life. When I couldn't make it as an actor after the first year in New York, I said, okay, I'm a stage manager now. And I was able to I was on Broadway in 2 years after that. Huge, saved my life. And it's so important. And I applaud. It's one of the things I love about SummerStock Austin. I remember 1 year we had a group of your people here. And, you know, we had someone playing a lead role in a musical on one, and then she operated the follow spot on the next show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And talk about two divergent areas of the business. I was always so very happy that y'all took that approach.
Well, and I think one of the special things about SummerStock is just the rigor is there. Even though there is a focus on working with young people and young artists, there's nothing watered down about the process,
right,
from the audition process to the rehearsal schedule to the actual performance schedule. So this is definitely a showcase of some tremendous talent in the Central Texas area and beyond.
That's mm-hmm. important, too. We are totally running out of time. So tell folks where they can get more information and when these are happening.
Absolutely. So we open in the Heights July 22nd. We open Alice's Wonderland, I think, July 28th.
That's what I just read.
Okay, perfect. And How To Musical Theater will premiere August 14th. Information for all of that can be found at impactarts.org, which is our new nonprofit that SummerStock is now part of.
Right. Which I know before I get to the next thing I was going to say to you is the plays, not the movie. When's the final performance? How much time is there?
Yes, we close August 8th.
August
8th. Is a Monday. We are aware it's a weird thing, but we do it.
We like Mondays. And great. In terms of Impact Arts, Ginger, I would love to get you back on the show in the short term to just talk about everything Impact Arts and learn a little bit more about you.
Is that
something that might interest you? That is great. Well, thank you guys so much for coming on, Michael and
thank
Ginger.
You.
Impactarts.org. It sounds like an amazing, amazing
season.
I was going to say show, but it's multiple shows.
Yeah.
We're going to go out here a little bit of Piragua, which is one of my favorite songs.
Yes.
It's so beautiful. And in the movie, sung by Lin-Manuel Miranda. But this isn't the movie.
Piragua, Piragua.
And we're back. You're listening to Offstage and On Air with Lisa and Matrix. We just have time to say goodbye.
Goodbye, my friends.
Thank you again for coming on and helping. And thank you to Michael and Ginger for coming along for the ride. It was great conversations today, I thought.
Yeah. Thank you for the invitation, Lisa.
Thank you for having us.
Any old time. I do want to say the things that we were going to talk about locally, which we're not. But I just want to remind folks that the Full Monty is playing over at TexArts. Austin Shakespeare is doing the Winter's Tale along with Austin Classical something. I didn't write it down. And then there's a wonderful thing at, not at Cold Town, but the Hideout Theater, The Sound of Made Up Music. These are made up musicals. And then, of course, out at the park in the heat is Newsies.
Yes.
If you want to get some papes, that's where you go.
Yeah.
Papes.
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 Yep. I would just want to play Crutchy.
Oh.
Interesting.
Well, just because I like the Crutchy. It's cute. Mm-hmm. Crutchy's cute. Mm-hmm. Anyway, we're almost done here. We've got John Hoffner coming here next with Austin Common Radio Hour. John, what are you talking about today?
We are talking about electric vehicles in the City of Austin program. Pretty exciting. Electric vehicles are cool.
Electric vehicles are cool. I like to call them EVs.
EVs, yeah. Some people know that, right? You don't want to use too many acronyms, right?
I'm just part of that's not actually an acronym. That is an initialism, to be clear. Unless you call it an EV. When I get a car, I'll call it an EV. But thank you all for joining us on Offstage and On the Air. I chose this last piece of music, which is a new release. It's a Goethe Das musical, and anytime there's a Das musical, I have to have it because Nicole and I love that. Goethe Das musical. That's or if you live in Chicago, you call that Goethe.
yes.
Fortunately, we don't live in Chicago. Here it is. We'll see you next week when we look at what's happening off stage and on the air. This song, by the way, Goethe Das Musical, is called Goethe with a question mark.
Ooh.
Der erste Kerl, das ist nicht das erste Mal.
Wir stehen rund wie Idioten hier im Saal.
Er kratzt am Ruf unseres Instituts.